I'm Fraser T. Smith, a music artist, record producer, musician and songwriter, and I've made an album called 12 Questions under the name Future Utopia. Each track on the record poses a deep philosophical question, and I've invited some of the sharpest minds in popular culture to answer these questions in order to help me and others navigate living in the modern world. In this episode, I welcome rapper, actor, screenwriter, children's author, and stand-up comic Ben Bailey Smith, aka Doc Brown, and rapper, musician, and artist Jelani Blackman. Guys, I really appreciate you doing this. Ben, we've never met, but I'm a massive fan.
Thank you. Likewise.
Massive fan.
Likewise.
Massive fan. And you know what?
You've done some amazing work, man.
This is a tune. This is a tune. This is proper.
That was so weird. Like, I was like, you know, I'm from Kilburn, and I was like around my mum's in Willesden, and I got a text from some guy. Like, he's like, "Oh, so and so gave me your number. Spragger Benz is over from Yard, like, for like a couple days, and he's just trying to get some rappers together. Would you be up for coming down?" It was like so out of the blue, and I was like, "Of course!" Like, I was thinking, I don't know where I'm gonna have to trek to, but I'll go, like, for Spragger.
It's amazing, gee.
And he was like, "Oh, I'm just recording in a studio in my house. If you can get to Willesden by this time," I was like, "Bruv, I'm at my mum's in Willesden, like, I can walk there in 3 minutes."
Wow.
And he gave me the address.
So how did the session go? He had that beat to play.
They just had a shitload of songs, bunch of producers. It was just like I walked in and it was just like there was weed and rum everywhere. All the windows have been like blocked out, so it was dark inside, but it was like the middle of the day and it was hot. And I went in the back, and Spragger's just like, he was just so on it, like, despite the fact that there was all these guys around, just enough Jamaican guys, enough weed, enough rum. Spragger was just there recording. He'd stop and he'd be like, what do you want to write about? I'd be like, "Ah, bro, it's your project, like, whatever." And he's like, "All right, boom, let's do this." And I think me and him recorded like 3 songs in,
wow,
in an hour, maybe more.
That is the way as well.
It was just like rare. Like, I don't even know why I'm here, how I'm here. This guy is just like, he made like 30 songs in like a couple of days, man. Like, the geezer's,
wow,
just different gravy.
And yeah. how much time do you spend in the studio rapping? Because obviously that's not what you're known for as much as people that know music know you as a serious guy.
Yeah, I mean, it's a weird existence for me because, you know, I tried to do serious rap for so long and it didn't happen. And then whenever I've gone back to it, it's been really hard to get anybody to take me seriously. So it's very...
In what capacity when you say that? Because people that know you with your incredible career that is making people laugh and the incredible work that you do, but...
Rap for me opened the door to creativity and the performance and the imagination and the ability to entertain that I always knew I had, but never really had the platform. And rap eventually created that platform, and it brought me in a very organic roundabout way to comedy, which brought me in a very organic roundabout way to writing for the screen, for adverts, and to acting. Do you know what I mean? So none of this was planned. It just all happened. But I can trace it back down the timeline to rap. And I've never fell out of love with rap. But I've never got the time to do it. So on the occasion that I do it, it's always like a feature with somebody else. So someone will ask me to come out of retirement, I'll do it. But people be like, "Rah, isn't this the comedy guy? Like, why is he rapping?" Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's just one of those things. It's kind of a bugbear, but at the same time, I respect it because I haven't got time to be the serious rapper that I wanted to be. So I can't start getting upset that I'm not spoken about in the same breath as Dave or Storms or Do you know what I mean? Like, it's that's not going to happen. That ship has sailed. But I'm quite comfortable with that as well, because I don't feel any pressure when I make music. I used to make it and then just I couldn't sleep because I was so worried about how I was going to bring it to people, the videos, the release date, you know, getting everyone paid, like rare, getting the right guests. There's a stress, you know, so I don't have that anymore. I can make music purely for love.
From me to you, you're a serious guy. You to me, would easily make a great career as a rapper, you know. And well,
thank you. It's been
lucky enough to meet and become friends with Idris Elba on this record, you know, and he is like you and is like you, Jelani, in that I just don't know where you guys have the time to practice and to be so talented across, you know, like Idris will... I think he feels the same thing. We had to earn his stripes. But as soon as that guy gets behind the decks, people are like, oh, this is great. It's Idris Elba, you know, the actor. And then he starts playing and people are amazed. And then he starts rapping and then he starts singing and he starts playing the guitar. That's like you. And that's like you, Jelani. I mean, I don't know if you know it, but I'd have to publicize this. Apart from being the most exciting new rapper on the scene at the minute, this guy played sax nice. On our record. The thing is about what impresses me so much is that you're not playing at it. Like, you're not playing at being a rapper, Ben. You're not playing on the sax. You know, I've got some serious sax on my record, Jelani. I mean, with all due respect, I was not in need of sax. But when you came with that sax on Am I Built Like This, just blew me away. So I'm in awe of you.
You know, Rakim played sax before he started rapping. Yeah, one of the great all-time old school rappers of the 80s. He played sax. Yeah. And he said in an early interview, I remember he was saying it helped teach him a different syncopation to for his approach to flowing as a rapper, you know. He treated his vocals much more as you know, this dance over the 4/4 beat that you would freeform with an instrument like a sax, you know. He treated his voice that way. So when he came out, you know, a lot of people say, oh, the thing that made him stand out was that all the 80s rappers, they were kind of corny and like ABC, Sesame Street stuff. And he was just cold, like his voice sounded cold. And that is one thing. But it was interesting to hear that also he was a musician already. So that would have set him aside from, you know, the Run DMCs and no disrespect, but, you know, like those other old school rappers.
Yeah, of course. It's awe-inspiring. I love hearing stories like that. Well, Ben Bailey-Smith, a.k.a. Doc Brown, Jelani Blackman, a.k.a. Jelani Blackman, thank you so much for being on this 12 Questions podcast. I'm excited to hear your answers to these questions. And I'm going to kick
I only
it straight.
Just scrolled down the email and realized there was questions.
No, that's so great. That's
whatever
great.
You get from me is going to be like very real.
No.
Might
same,
be wrong.
Same.
Top of the dome, freestyle.
Do you ever do that, Jamali, where like you get sent the stuff and you're like, yeah, cool, man's on it. Like, yeah, I'll be there. And then the thing starts and you're like, rah, man, skim read the email. Like,
hey, can I just say this?
Skimmed the thing.
This happened to me last week. I went to a thing. I thought it was an event. I was like, oh, it's nice, like, for people to be out again and like doing stuff. So I thought I was going to an event, and I turned up, and they were like, yeah, cool. So have you got your freestyle ready? I was like, sorry, what? They're like, oh yeah, like so it would be taking you to like hair and makeup, and then you'd be doing this thing. I was like, right. I think they're a little bit bugged out by the fact that I didn't know that that's what I was doing. But it's all right.
Sometimes it happens.
So like, yeah, sometimes it's good. Probably would have been thinking about it too much if I hadn't. So
there you go. Yeah, cool. Nervous energy sometimes the best.
Can I tell you a story about lack of research that happened once? Yeah, I was approached to be on a radio show going out in Scotland. It was equivalent of Kiss FM in Scotland, and I obliged. I was kind of weirded out because I don't know, at that time of my career, I was definitely not. I hadn't released my artist project, and it was definitely something that was weird, but I thought maybe it was some kind of like producer corner or some little thing. And the nearer it got to it, I was getting emails saying like the people, you know, up in Glasgow are really excited for this, and we've got a panel of people, and we're going to put like the phones open to Glasgow, and we're going to, and I mean, look, you could say my ego got the better of me, but there was a massive voice inside my head just going, this sounds weird. So anyway, we set it up and called the number, and the guy was like, man, really, really pleased. And he said Fraser, bearing in mind that what's about to come. It's a phrase, I'm so pleased to have you on this show. It's amazing. Everyone's so excited and like, congratulations with everything. And I was thinking, this, it just, I don't know, this feels a bit weird. So he said, I'll pass you over to the presenter and literally we'll be on and we've got like a guest panel and we'll open the phones up to people. And so I stood by and they said, okay, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, here we go. And the presenter went, and we are live now with the great Phaser from N-Dubs. Here he is on the line. Right? So I had three options. Number one, put the phone down. Disappoint all these people. Number two, the option was to say, look, guys, I'm really sorry, but I'm actually not Phaser, I'm Fraser T. Smith. I have actually worked with N-Dubs, and that could have been an option. Mm-hmm. Or option three was to pretend I was Dappy live on air. What was the option that I picked? One, two, or three?
Oh, are you asking what you pick?
Yeah.
What do you think? I'd be Dappy.
Yeah, I'm going three as well, Dappy.
You'd have been, no, Phaser.
Phaser.
Did I say Dappy?
You just said Dappy, yeah.
Ah, sorry.
No, you
sorry,
said
sorry,
Phaser
sorry.
And then you said Dappy.
Okay, sorry.
So you pretended to be Phaser?
I pretended for half an hour to be Phaser.
Did you do the voice and everything?
I don't know what his voice, I mean, I remembered him, but I didn't do
wait,
it like that.
Wait, does that exist?
that has to be somewhere.
That's got to be somewhere,
surely,
yeah.
Surely. That's amazing. He must have woken up one day being like, right, this weren't me in this interview.
When the guy, when it finished and I was speaking to the guy, I said, look, it's been a terrible mistake here. And he said, what do you mean? I said, you haven't done your research. I'm not Phaser. This is Fraser. And he was like, oh, okay. Well, he goes, well, who are you? I said, well, I'm a producer. And he goes, all right. He goes, who have you worked with? I said, well, I've recently just been working with Britney Spears and CeeLo Green. He goes, do you think you can get CeeLo Green on the thing, on the show?
Oh my God.
And I said, so now look, he has to be an agent. I don't want an apology, but you just put me through the most weird experience of my life.
Horrendous.
And, you know, I've tried to like keep everyone happy, but anyway, the Sarah, my manager and wife, manager at the time, emailed the record company, Richard Castillo, that looked after them. And he thought it was the funniest thing. He was like, what? So Fraser pretended to be Phaser. And he said, well, actually, thank God that was like, I don't think Phaser really gives interviews. So yeah. Like, he was really thankful. He was like, does Fraser want to do any more for Phaser? But yeah, that was weird. But anyway, I digress. Jelani, question one, yes. Fear or faith?
I think it's probably the same thing, to be honest.
Okay.
Yeah, I think people are... only they have faith out of fear of accepting that you can't really be sure of anything.
That's cool. I like that. I like that.
I also didn't know this is what we were doing, but I'm in it. I'm into it.
Neither did I. So we're in the same boat.
This is the 12 questions.
But I'm into it. But I'm into, to be fair, I do know the questions, but like, yeah. I'm into it. That's my answer to that. I think fear comes from lack of faith and faith comes from too much fear.
That's a great answer. And don't feel the need to... that like, shit, I haven't done any research on this or... Yeah.
No, it's not an excuse. I like the fact that it's straight off the dome.
It's straight off the dome, yeah. Top of the dome. And and also these answers can be super concise.
Yeah.
There's no right or wrong answer, which is what I love.
Yes.
So, Ben, how much is enough?
I mean, what a question. I've always struggled with perfectionism. You know, and wanting everything to be just so, and it's a very dangerous habit to cultivate over time, especially if you're an artist. Because my eldest daughter, she hates creative subjects at school. She's 15.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she hates like English, drama, anything where there's not a definite answer. You know. She likes like science or maths or whatever, where it's just like you're either right or you're wrong, you know. Mm. When teachers say to her, "There's no wrong answer. Don't worry, there's no wrong answer." That sends her into a turmoil.
She'd hate this podcast.
I kind of understand that. I mean, obviously, I'm an artist, so I love it when someone says there's no wrong answer. But yeah, the issue with that, as you build as a creative entity throughout your life. From a child to you know, young adult to an adult, is that you're constantly looking for the right way to do this thing that has no wrong answer. So there's never this. I mean, do you know any musician anywhere who's made an album that they turn around and go, that was perfect, start to finish, loved it? Invariably, even on an album that their fans think is 100% perfection, they'll do like one last song after they've got the 12 for the album, and they'll be like, this is the one. But only because it's the most recent one, not because it's good enough to be one of the 12. But they don't see it, they got the blinkers on. That's what I relate to. So, you know, there's never ever enough, and that is hugely problematic. And the only way that I've been able to deal with that in recent times is to tell myself that good is good enough. Like, I'm constantly amazed when I do stuff and people say, this is amazing, I love this, I love this thing you did, I love that. And I look back at doing it and think, my God, at the time I thought that was so shit. I thought like I was terrible, you know, I thought I was nervous, I was unsure of myself, or it just wasn't my proudest moment, it wasn't my best day. But you've got to let that stuff go, because there's no way of being an artist without sharing your art, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if you don't share it, what is it? It's, I don't know if it means anything. And once you share it, what people read into it is what people read into it, you know? And if they think it's perfect, great. If they think it's shit, fair enough, that's an opinion. But the crucial thing is for you not to get caught up in like, oh my God, I've got to do something better than that. Better than that, better than that, better than that. You know, another horrific addiction of artists is that we create our magnum opus, this thing we've been working towards for ages. We share it with the world and we can't enjoy that moment. We're just like, but what's the next thing? You know, what's the next thing? Because, you know, that's out there, but maybe I'm finished now. Maybe that's the best I could do. I've got to think about the next thing. And we get caught in this loop of like, not enjoying the spoils, like, you know, put your thing out, have people enjoy it, take on those spoils and enjoy those, you know, that like good is good enough.
There's a lot of wisdom in there.
But unfortunately, I think for a lot of us, there's never enough.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true. I definitely hear you with the perfectionism thing as well. But also I think it's probably what drives me to get up early in the morning and true. To go again, because I think we are all searching for that perfect recording or that perfect beat or that perfect. And maybe when you've released something that you feel is perfect, maybe that is when you need to stop and do something else. Maybe that's the human condition that keeps us grounded and keeps us humble.
Maybe.
That's an interesting thing. There's lots of wisdom there for young artists and across every genre of culture there, Ben.
Yeah, I think, you know, the crucial thing is to just keep creating without any self-consciousness, you know. Don't worry about what people are going to think, or, you know, even what you think of it. Just create it, get it done, and then worry about all of like what it means and all of that later, you know.
Can I just say a funny thing about that question specifically? So, you know, you gave out those packs with the album promo thing to people that were involved. So the mask that you had said, how much is enough? And like, just coincidentally, the first time, because I was like rushing around, the first time I'd gone out to do anything, I put it on, and it was to go and see, going to the summer exhibition at the RA. And it just looked like I was making such a point. And people kept looking at me being like, who's this dickhead? Walking around the next exhibition, like with just obviously I would be like, how much is enough?
That's why I never wear t-shirts with shit on them. I never wear t-shirts with like phrases or words on them, because you're so sort of tied to that phrase. Like, people 100%. Just go, oh, is that what it is? Okay, all right. Is that what you're about?
Jelani, that's a question. That's
it's a real question, yeah.
You know, that's, if it was a statement, if it was like, enough is enough, but it's a question, you know?
Yeah, it is a question.
You're just walking around looking at the Picasso.
Question, how much? They're all, you know, they're all like differently priced as well, because they're like, yeah. So it's a good thing to ask.
Jelani, do we really care?
No, we do. I think we just care too much. And there's been a lack of focus for a long time of what is important to care about. So I guess one of the biggest things in life for me, and that I found a challenge for a lot of people, is purpose and lack of purpose. And when people find it, they can excel and become brilliant. And when they don't, very often, like, a lot of talent gets squandered, or just there's a lot of dissatisfaction. And I've had a lot of dissatisfaction in my life. And I think it's because I like to do a lot of things at once. So I never really know what my purpose is. And there's something really satisfying about people that know it. And I'm always fascinated by, I guess, younger people who, like, at like 15, 16 are like, I want to do this. Mm. This is going to be my route, and have that purpose. And it's not always an easy path, but the purpose drives them onwards. And I guess it wasn't until recently that I found purpose in what I do, because I realized that I'd been doing it so casually for so long in terms of music that I didn't realize that it is my purpose. And that, and I, at least for this moment in time, is, and I do care about it. So I do want to invest in it. And the more that I found that, the more satisfying it became. But a lot of the time I speak to loads of people, I'm like, so like what, like, hobbies sounds kind of flippant, but what do you like to do?
Yeah.
People don't really know. They're like,
think it's realistic to make that hobby, that thing that they do know that they like, to make that something they do every day. They just don't think that is a viable option.
No. So they care about things that are irrelevant, or at least not necessarily fulfilling in the same way that it would be if you had, like, something real to cling on to. Like, they care about what they look at, love people.
Or perhaps just not worth the energy. But I think one thing I would add to that concept of caring is that, from the other side of things, it is scary to care. Like, once you start to give a shit, then your heart can get broke, you know. Mm. And be that in a relationship, be that your, you know, profession, be that how you see the world and your responsibility as a human being within the world. If you really start to care, it can be scary. Like, what if you care as much as like Greta Thunberg? Then you lose your childhood. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
What if you care about this man or this woman so much that when they cheat on you, break your heart, like, you're empty. There's nothing left because you focus so much tunnel vision on this person. Like, actually caring is, it can build a lot of anxiety. It's easier to not give a shit, you know.
I would say, as an extension, like, I guess I've always felt when people are aware of certain things, it broadens their scope so much that it becomes challenging. So, like, when you actually have to accept that the world is bigger than your small patch of it, it becomes very scary. And then, like, you're like, oh, what if I do care about this? And you see it all the time on social media. It's like, oh, well, if I make a point about this thing, do I also have to care about this thing equally? Are people going to call me out for saying that, well, you said this about Black Lives Matter, but you didn't say this about transphobia? Like, how much can you care, and what do you have to focus on to make sure that it all stays relevant? I think people want to, but it's easier than done.
Our natural instinct is to love, because that was our very first currency, you know, as human beings. Before we had anything else, sex, money, power, careers, before we had anything, we had love. I know some of us didn't, but they turn out to be fucking psychos. Do you know what I mean? Hmm. Most of us had some love from one or two parents, you know, or surrogates, adopted, whatever it is. We had love. So our main thing is to care, but doing it, as Jelani just said very well, like, it seems to bring on board a lot more than the average person can chew. The first time I clocked it was as a youngster, like, giving a pound to a homeless person, and then I passed another one a couple minutes later, and I was like, rah, like,
yeah.
I'm not gonna give it another pound. Like, I've done my bit. So it's like, what's the limit, you know?
Yeah, that's very true. It's very true. There's a lot of food for thought in both those answers. This is an interesting question for you, Ben. What's in a name?
That is a good question for me, because, you know, I actually said to my mum, my mum came around the other day, right? And bizarrely, this is not some, like, bullshit plug, because I don't even know when this podcast is coming out, but as a time of recording, tomorrow, my first novel comes out, right? By some bizarre twist of fate, My mum's first novel is always also coming out tomorrow. Different publisher. Wow. Different publisher. Neither of us have ever tried to write a novel before. That's just the way it happened. And she came round with a copy of her book, and I was like, oh yeah, lovely. And it was funny, like I looked at her name on there, Yvonne Bailey Smith. She's got it with a hyphen, right? I've got Ben Bailey Smith, no hyphen. My sister is just Zadie Smith. And my brother is Luke Skies. That's all our professional names. But none of those are our actual real names, really. Do you know what I mean? Mm. And I think it's interesting that we've all not even created, this all happened relatively organically, but we've all added like just a slight tweak to who we, what our real name is, in order to bring what we do to the world, you know? And for me, I think that's like a sub, I can't speak for the rest of my family, but I think for me, it's like a subconscious way of going, this guy is for you, and then the rest of this guy is for me and my friends and the people that I actually really know. You can't have him. I'll give you like 95% of me, all right? And you can buy all that shit. You can fucking love me. You can hate me. You can make my career. You can break my career. Whatever. But there's 5% that you're never, ever getting. Otherwise, I can't exist. And some people give 100%, you know, Richard Pryor, people like that give absolutely everything. There's no positive end to that. Mm. If you give everything, you die, man. Like sometimes literally, it's so a weird feel thing.
That when you go on stage as Doc Brown, that safeguards.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say like with Doc Brown, it's way more plain, like, because as a rapper, I mean, from my era, you didn't really give yourself a name. You got given a name by somebody, and that's what you went with. But once I had it, the first thing I did was battle other rappers. You know, I used to battle rappers live, on stage, freestyle, improvise, you know. And to be Doc Brown was, as soon as I started winning, that was like my bulletproof persona. So for me, I don't even remember making the decision when I moved into stand-up to retain the name. And I kind of regret not just using my own name in stand-up, just like everybody else. But it's interesting that I retained the name, because I think, again, like stand-up's as naked as battling, I think, if not more.
Yes. I could never, I love performing. I could never imagine doing stand up.
That's the hardest thing I've ever done.
Raw. It feels so raw and exposed, like just the others. Yeah.
The last time I did it was 4 years ago, you know? Whereas a lot of people will probably watch my shit on rotation or whatever and think that I'm still doing it. Like, I haven't done it for 4 years because that happened to me. I was like, my whole life was in that, was on that stage, and it became incredibly draining. You know, I remember talking to Ricky Gervais about it, because he really didn't want me to stop. And actually, the day I quit was in the middle of a world tour with him, you know, in the middle, not at the end. So he wasn't best pleased. And I remember him saying to me, dude, like, lean more into the character. He's like, we're all characters. Like, people think of comedy characters, they think of Steve Coogan doing Alan Partridge. He's like, we're no different. All of us, we're exactly the same as Alan Partridge. We're just selling them a chunk of what they think is our lives. Like Ricky's character on stage is nothing like him as a person. Nothing. Do you know what I mean? He sells this kind of arrogant, boisterous, button pushing kind of like, I want an argument about everything. I want an argument about, like, if you're religious, you're a dick. If you're this, if you've made that decision, you're a dick. He's just pushing buttons. He's being provocative. If you hang with him, bro, like, he's like just vegetarian, like, hangs with his missus, his cat. Like, we drink a beer, like, eat some cheese. It's like chilled, man. Like, he's such a, like, lover of people and of the world. But that's not funny. Do you know what I'm saying? On stage, that's not...
It's not funny.
What's that? It's like, yeah. Oh, what, you're just a really nice guy. Great. Like, you know, so there's Ricky Gervais, the man, and then there's Ricky Gervais, the character on stage. And I always struggled to do that. I always thought, the truth is funny as fuck, so I'm just going to tell the truth. But that is actually, it's draining. I didn't realize that. Years of doing that is incredibly, it can be traumatic. So yeah, I suppose long story short, like there's a lot in a name if you think of that as a representation of how you present yourself to the world, you know, what you choose to tell people, whether you're an artist, performer or not, you know, if you're just a civilian, like what you choose to share with people about yourself, there's a lot in that. And it begins with your name. It begins with your, you know, your first representation of yourself. And what do we sell to? We all do that, right? We all, you know, I can't remember what comic it was. Maybe it was Chris. I think it was Chris Rock, actually. Yeah, I think it was Chris Rock. He said, when you're meeting a girl, she's not meeting you. She's meeting your representative, right? And he was making that point of like everyone's a performer at first, you know, like they're choosing what they want to give you, and of course they're going to give you the greatest hits, right? Try and make a good first impression. So like as an artist, it's like that, but intensified, and it could be, you know, over the course of your whole lifetime.
Did you feel, just touching on the novel that you're about to release, did you feel nervous releasing a novel that, or I mean, have you done a lot of writing that Zadie's read before? I mean, this is, you know, you're coming out of a pretty prestigious stable there. I mean, I read White Teeth. That's like 20 years ago now.
Yeah.
And I mean, she's a seminal piece of
she's
work.
She's literary royalty, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the authors she fucks with are royalty as well. Like, you know, you go around her house anytime, like when she lived in the States, she lived in Rome. In London, you go around a house any given time in any one of those three places, there could be like your favorite author just sat there. Do you know what I mean? Dave Eggers, flipping Irvin Welsh. Do you know what I mean? There'd be someone just there, like, and you're like, rad. That's who she's mixing with. The best of the best, because she is one of them. She's one of them. But I never felt any pressure. And again, I go back to that organic thing. Like, I never planned to do any of this shit. So when my kids were little, my friend who also had little kids, he was a storyboard artist. Mm. He was like, I'm bored of this shit, doing storyboards for adverts. I want to draw a picture book, but I can't write for shit, you know? So he sent me pictures of this bear and he was like, could you write a story about this bear? And I was like, yeah, of course. You know, he's like, do it in rhyme, you know, like a rap. I was like, of course I can do that. I wrote it real quick. And we ended up getting a book deal off that. So that was the first step. And then as I did more picture books for little ones, more publishers would be like, have you ever thought about writing for older kids or for adults? You know, and I was like, no. Frankly, that seems like a lot of work. Picture books like 32 pages, you know. It's just like a verse of rap, like done. But eventually, like it got to that stage where I was like, actually, why not? Like, why not? You know, it would just be an interesting intellectual challenge. So I said yes to Bloomsbury. And then when the reality hit me, I was like, this is a terrible decision. 65, 70,000 words. It's a lot of words. 350 pages. Like, it's no joke. But then the lockdown hit and that was it. That was like a sign from the universe going, have a bash. What else are you going to do? You know, and it gave me drive and purpose over the past year and a half. I don't know if I would have done it outside of that. But in answer to your question about Zadie, I never felt any pressure from her because it was just such a different world. You know, like for me, I was writing for young adults, or YA as they call it, you know, older kids. With this novel, I never felt like I was treading on her toes. I never felt like, oh my God, how could I ever show this to her? Because I felt very confident about the world that I was writing about. And I felt very confident that she would never want to do that, you know? So, and I also felt very confident that I could never write anything like the books she's written. And obviously I've read them all. So I'm speaking from authority here. You know, some of her books, you're talking about 2, 3, 4 years of research before pen goes to fucking paper. Wow. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's not how I operate, bro. I didn't even read the fucking email for this podcast. You know what I mean?
I'm sure she's as in awe of you as you are of her. I mean, has she got bars? She could drop a verse on a beat?
Nah. She's the worst for remembering lyrics. Like, she will literally text me and go, what did Biggie say on this song that we've been listening to for 25 years? Like,
she got any jokes in the locker?
What's the bar? Well, she's funny. She's funny anyway, but no, she would never do stand-up. I mean, she doesn't even do interviews. But if you read her work, her sense of humor is highly sophisticated. But we were raised on comedy, me and her. Like, we were raised on comedy. Our dad made us watch, like, a lot of shit that I don't think most kids that age would watch. And it informed us a lot, I think.
Well, there are two parents that must be incredibly proud of their children. You know, whatever they were doing, whatever they were putting in the Weetabix.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because we're not from artists. We're just from two working class people, you know, who... I think the key thing about them was that their lives were fascinating to us, you know? Yeah. Their lives were mad interesting.
We had Julie Adenuga on the pod. Julie Adenuga, who's obviously... Her family is an incredible stable of creative cultural powerhouses, you know, and I think she was saying the same, because we were talking, you know, how was it growing up in your household? So super interesting. Jelani, why are we divided when we're so connected?
Oof. You know, I got so lost in listening. I switched off. Why are we so divided when we're connected? Well, I would say that in a lot of ways, we are not connected at all. It's a bit of a fallacy. We feel like we are because we can see each other and we know what each other are doing. But I think it's way more interesting when you don't have that immediacy of connection and or like the appearance of it. So I know that some people that I speak to, they're like, oh, did you know that so-and-so is doing this or so-and-so is doing that? I'm like... No, but they're actually my friends and I speak to them all the time. So it's interesting to me that I don't know, but I think it's because I haven't seen them. Because if I'd seen them in person, I would know and they would have told me, we would have caught up. But these other people that actually don't know these people as well, like are like, oh, you know this person's doing this and this person's doing that. And so it gives the kind of illusion that they're all connected and they all know what each other are doing, but they're not connecting in reality. And so I think it's a bit of an abstractness to how it looks. I think we are quite divided, especially after this year. There's a really interesting moment where the degradation of something special showed how quickly our connections and apparent community become something different. So, you know, the clap for the NHS. Mm-hmm. I remember the first time I heard that and I was like, wow. Like, that's actually something I've never come across in my entire life. So that feeling of unifying, like, behind a cause and for everyone to feel connected. And it did feel like that. And not quickly, but definitely over the course of a few months, it almost became representative of how divided we are, because the cause that we were all behind isn't actually in reality something that we can change or support. There were people that were asking us to do something that had no interest in that, or making people come together behind the NHS. It's a joke, really, how they're treated and the way that the staff have been treated. But we had this moment where everyone was connected and it seemed like everyone was together. But actually, in the end, it just highlighted how divided the difference between human interest and commercial financial interests are. So I think we had the appearance of being connected, but actually... When you look behind the surface, we actually are extremely divided.
I agree with every element of that, but at the same time, do you think?
Just out of necessity as well, we do need to be divided because we aren't naturally in, we weren't all meant to be in the same community. Like globally, it's a big world with lots of people with different opinions. So to connect and to expect everyone to be on the same page, I think is unrealistic. I think it's unrealistic and unfair.
I think that's really, really salient. I agree with everything you said. Everything. I wonder if there's another level to connection. he's saying that we weren't meant to be together. It's interesting because we are separate originally because we became nomadic, right? But at some stage we were all together, and then we became nomadic and we became all these different tribes in different parts of the world, and our skin colors gradually changed, and we adapted to our environments, and our language gradually changed. I wonder if, like, on a deeper level, there is like an energetic connection between human beings. I mean, the first time I remember thinking this was at a football match when I was young, and my team was behind, and there was just this desire from the crowd for the team to get back in the game that felt so strong that I could see the players feeling that pressure. They could feel the energy from the crowd, and eventually got back into it. When they scored the equalizer, it just felt nailed on that they were going to score another goal and win it, which is exactly what happened. And I really remember leaving thinking, we willed that to happen. Somehow, 25,000 people together wanting the same thing affected 11 guys on the pitch who wanted it but didn't. They didn't know how to do it. And that energy somehow created this outcome, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know that I'd agree with any of those other 25,000 people's politics or, you know, what they believe in, or whether I'd even fucking like them outside the stadium.
In that
moment, there was an energetic connection. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
There's, Will VAR.
There's a, I feel like, yeah.
No, we were at the FA Cup final. Sorry to cut you, Jelani, but just talking about football, we were at the FA Cup final, Leicester fan through and through. The first time we were ahead looking to win the FA Cup final, Ben Chilwell, 89th minute or 88th minute, scores that great goal.
Mm.
We were like, the only thing that can save us here is VAR. So the VAR decision is there, and it's however many Leicester fans all around the world, like, VAR, please make this offside. And grace of God, his knee just was that inch over the line. The funny thing is, it's the amount of Chelsea fans that said that was a dubious decision. How can VAR be dubious? Take the loss. Champions League finals, but
on an offside, it's not.
On an offside, that's what I'm saying. So how can you say that? I didn't want to be like the cocky.
So do you think you manifested the manifestation is definitely a real thing. Like I'm
you can will shit to happen, right?
You can will it. Well, I mean, do you know what? On a really basic level, the way that I would that I saw it written once is just you become the thing that you think about the most. That's just common sense, because that is what you're putting your energy into. Like, regardless of whether it's good or bad, you become the thing you think about most, because out of necessity, your brain can only process one thing at a time. But just on what you're saying about the universal element, I definitely agree that at a time we were together, and there's my dissertation was on just where music resides, and because it doesn't exist semantically, purely semantically, doesn't exist just in acoustically. There's something fundamentally we understand to be music. So there must be a universal understanding somewhere, but at the same time, everywhere you go, there are different interpretations, and different people will take it on in different ways. So I think, there's at a very evolutionary level, we are universally connected. But I think the things that challenge us on a practical and ideological cultural level mean that it's actually quite hard to find a plateau or some kind of middle ground where everybody can meet, because then you have to lose too much of yourself.
Yeah,
and actually that means that you have to lose what makes you culturally different, and loses your humanity. It's a balance, but I think out of necessity we are divided, but our intentions would be to be connected as much as possible.
Wonderful answers, guys. Wonderful answers. Now look, we've reached the halfway point, half time. We could keep going, but I'm conscious of your time. I'm really conscious of your time. So what I want to do, if it's okay with you, not to catch you out, because I really want to get to the 12, because otherwise we're going to get 8. And 8 of the 12 questions, just, I don't know.
No, we've got to do 12.
We've got to do 12. So how about we do quick fire? Bang, bang, bang.
Yeah.
Yeah? So, Ben, how do we find our truth?
How do you answer that in a quick fire?
That's the thing.
What a question.
Look. Come on.
What a question.
You guys are masters in your field of being put on the spot.
Yeah.
That's why I know you're not going to be scared by this.
Yeah, no, for real. And of course, brevity and levity. Being really honest with yourself is super, super hard, because, you know, the big questions that you need to ask yourself about, like, why you procrastinate so much, are you in the right relationship, or are you, you know, you better being single, or is the grass greener on the other side? Like, all those questions, like, that keep you up at night, they're very difficult to answer, because deep down, the only guarantee in life is death, right? So there's an, if you really think too hard about your truth in terms of your existence, you start to think life is meaningless, so you might as well just kill yourself. So it's like, it's really hard to find absolute truth in yourself without entering into like nihilism, I think. So I think the best way to go about it, and I'm only speaking for me, I'm not telling anybody else how to do it, is just to keep your head up and your eyes open, keep your earphones out, like just walk around and try and observe, breathe in like life. I notice when I do that, I connect to loads of strangers, I talk to strangers, and we cut through bullshit really quickly, and I find myself speaking my truth, you know, to people.
Great answer.
So yeah, in as succinct a way as possible, I would say that. Just eyes open.
Great answer. Jelani, what's the cost of freedom?
Oh, can I just say before I answer it, better the things that you've said are exactly how I would answer that question. It's mad. So it's been nice to hear it just articulated other ways.
Well, I'd like to think we were connected, Jelani, but
yeah,
obviously we're not.
Nah. No, that's it. We're connected in the universal way. Sorry, let me get back to the question. What's the cost of freedom? Oh, I guess I would say the cost of being free is the willingness to accept that you don't have control over anything. Once you accept that, then I think you can truly be free. I think the way that people perceive freedom if you take freedom as something that is your right, it's not. I mean, it's something that you can earn, you can get, but I think you have no right to be free, I think. And once you accept that, everything else kind of opens up, and you can appreciate that what you have is what you have. The limitations of what you have are the limitations. And yeah, that would be my answer.
That's a great answer.
Absolutely.
Ben, is it too late to save the planet?
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, I read a lot of very negative things about it. But if it is, it is. I mean, sometimes I think, as much as I would love to save the planet, and, you know, I do my little bit of recycling, thinking that might help, you know, I also think maybe there's an arrogance in us thinking that we can do it. Like, maybe our time is just up at some point, you know, like, who the fuck are we? In terms of the history of the universe, who the fuck are we?
Yeah.
You know, trust. So sometimes I think, like, even talking about it shows our arrogance. And I know that sounds weird, because that sounds like I'm saying, oh, I don't care about the planet. Of course I do. I don't have a God. So, like, you know, nature really is my God. Like, when it snows and I can't do shit, I'm like, wow, that is a power that is way higher than me. You know, I respect the planet massively. But the very concept of saving it, I think, we're not the fucking Avengers, man. We're just some monkeys who learn how to talk. Do you know what I mean? Like, we're just no great shakes. I think the arrogance, the best.
The arrogance thing is interesting, because a few people have said, and Katrin Friedrichs on the record said that, well, to paraphrase, but said that, you know what, the planet is actually okay. You know, it's us that needs to fix ourselves. So it is arrogant. Don't you worry about the planet. The planet can survive just well enough without you guys on it, without us guys making a mess of things.
Yeah, it's proved that already.
It will keep going another zillion years, after we've all gone. And we've internally combusted and heated up this planet to the point where, like, everything's a desert, and we have to say the planet will keep going. It's a really good point that it's the human race that needs to change, not the planet. You know, it's very interesting. Jelani, what happens next?
Ooh. I think that there are a few options. I couldn't agree more with the sentiment there. there is just an arrogance and a self-righteousness in the belief that we have some kind of control over our destinies, like manifest over, yeah, as humans. I think what happens next is we chase our tails. I think the best way that I can describe it is, I remember, I love film, and I remember there was a point watching 90s films where the future looked really, really different to how it looks now. And it was wild. Like if you watch like sci-fi from the 90s, it's crazy. Like it's fucking, their vision of the future is insane. And as time went on, I feel like Children of Men was probably one of the first properly like dystopian moments when it was like, actually shit, that our perception of what the future will be is coming more and more in line with what it already is. And our ability to see something different to, I guess, the path that we've put ourselves on in terms of technology, in terms of the kind of exponential rise in loads of ideological visions, but like the kind of dystopian nature of what we want out of the planet and where we're at. What happens next, you just have to watch something and our lack of ability to see further than that, I think tells you that what happens next, we already know. Like, I think all we have to do, we already know what's coming. We already can see the connection. Like, we're actually doing it to ourselves currently. We're like, have you ever seen Boston Dynamics? It's fucking insane. Boston Dynamics robots are literally something out of Black Mirror. And we're looking at it being like, cool, shall we carry on? Yeah, I guess so. Looking at data grabs, looking at the way that we're taking people's personal security and freedoms and destroying it all and being like, yeah, cool, shall we continue? Let's continue. So I think a positive person would say there'll be a breaking point where it either comes good or it doesn't. Me as a slight cynic would say, I think we've written our scripts. We may not live to see what happens, but what will happen, we already know.
Super interesting. Ben, this is an interesting question for you, and it's one that Jelani answered in his incredible verses on Am I Built Like This? We talked for about 3 hours in the studio about nature or nurture. What's your answer to nature or nurture?
Yeah, I mean, it's the age-old question, isn't it? I don't think there is any definitive answer. I think it's really interesting. It's an endlessly interesting topic because we're always questioning whether we have free will, whether we have like a life sort of laid out for ourselves, whether this way we behave is always going to be like that because of XYZ in the past. And I've had the opportunity to really look at this firsthand in that my wife is adopted. So, you know, if it's nature, surely she should be exactly like her birth parents were, but she isn't. So should she then be exactly, should she reflect the house that she went into having been adopted? Not necessarily. There is elements of all four of the parents in her life and the two very different environments that she experienced within her as an adult. They all play their part. But in terms of nature, I mean, you have to lean a lot on genetics. And I think, you know, there's mental health things that can be handed down genetically, but obviously the main one is physicality, and neither of those things are necessarily going to determine everything that happens in your life. You have to take on some environmental aspects. So there really is no definitive answer to that. And if someone does give a definitive answer, then I'd just love to sit with that person and hear that theory through, because no matter how much I think about it, my head just goes round in circles and I get tied up in knots, because, you know, sometimes I think I'm completely separate from my parents and everything that they went through and their pasts and their families, their respective families. And other times I look at myself and think, you're just reliving half of your mum's experiences and half of your dad's. Like, you're not an original being. So, you know, I don't know if there is an answer to that.
Jelani, what matters most?
For me, peace, to be honest, in myself. I do care about other people, I really deeply do, but I think peace in yourself is the most important thing. And if you can find that, you know what, actually, no, I was about to say something I don't agree with. I was going to say, if you can find that, because if you can find that in someone else, then that's as valuable. I actually don't think that's the case. I think you really need to find it in yourself,
yeah,
however that may be. And if you can find it in someone else, that's great and amazing. And that can add to your own peace and contentment. But I think what matters most is being at peace with yourself, content in yourself, and the world and environment that you place yourself in. And doing it as much as possible for other people, but start with yourself.
Yeah, you can't love without love, you know? You can't love without loving yourself.
No, and if you find it in someone else, it only becomes negative at some point, because that's too much pressure. You can't make someone else responsible for your happiness or your peace or your love. Or you have to be responsible for that. That's what matters.
Absolutely. And I've definitely done that in the past. Just like, hope someone else will save me. They'll work me out. They'll read my mind and they'll make me feel better about myself. Yeah, it doesn't work that way.
It doesn't work. It has to be you.
Ben, talking of love, you got the last question. What is love?
Oh, well, I think it's very close to what Jelani just explained, man. I mean, it's taken me a long time to not even love myself, but to like myself, you know. That was the first step. And loving myself, I'm still working on. But I think I felt real love or something that approached what I'd heard about love when I strengthened the relationship with my daughters, you know, because I think when they first came around, I was living out a suitcase as a live artist and wasn't spending the time that really I should have been spending. When I saw the light and changed my priorities, the feeling of this constant low level anxiety, this constant like panic, this worry, this concern of what they're doing, when, or where they are, I realized, oh my God, that this is love. This is what the fuck it is, man. It's like, you give a shit. Like, you really, really give a shit about another person. And, you know, I've always been very self-centered and focused on myself and my own goals, you know. So that was a real eye-opener. And I think, I guess in short, that love is empathy, man. It's actually being empathic for other people and crucially for yourself. Because it's very, very hard to give it if you don't feel it for yourself. It's a bizarrely easy thing to disguise, you know. You could be a people pleaser, or you can learn how to say the right things and disguise that as love in order to get the affection that you crave. But it's all base, it's all surface until you find real serenity, you know. And that, you know, that's the middle name of my younger daughter, because that's, I didn't even realize it when I gave it to her that's what I was searching for. You know, I actually put it on my wrists, you know, it's the middle name of my eldest, the middle serenity. Name of my youngest, liberty and serenity, peace and freedom, you know. And I didn't realize until 10 years after their birth, maybe more, that those were two things I was searching for within myself and had never come close to finding, because I was focused on so many surface things. So yeah, if you ask me what is love, I would say it was those two things, peace and freedom within yourself, you know, to let go and let, some people would say let God, but I would say let go and let the universe decide, you know, understand that you can't control shit, you know, then you can start to find and discover real love. Just surrender, man. Just surrender. It's so simple and so fucking hard at the same time.
Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, it's ironic to me that, yeah, like I say, serenity and liberty are the things that I was searching for. Those are the things that I love, and they are my daughter's names as well, who are the people that taught me how to love.
So. Do you know what, it's mad when you look back at stuff that you didn't know that you were saying to yourself at the time.
Yeah, I was fucking telling myself.
It happens all the time. Yeah, it happens so much when you name things or you write stuff or you make decisions that you didn't know you were doing. It's fascinating looking back at how you can be so unaware of the things that you needed, but you knew you were driving towards them. It's amazing.
Unreal.
Yeah.
Signs from the universe.
Yeah, man.
What a great last answer. But guys, I've spent an hour with you both and I feel like I'm an enlightened human being.
It's been good. Good
Thank
chat,
you
good
so
chat.
Much.
Good job, for, man. I needed
for these
that.
Incredible yeah. these incredible answers and hanging out with us for this hour.
Nah, pleasure.
Chilani, you when we spoke to you earlier, you were a little cagey, I must admit, about this project. You know, you were like, it's not an album, I'm fine with that. I just can't wait to hear whatever this project is, because anything that you're involved with, I'm immediately a fan. Ben, massive, massive congratulations releasing your first novel. I can't wait to read it. And
thank you, bro.
Let's all get in the studio.
Yeah, bro, you got to get me out of retirement. Like, anybody who needs a verse, needs a concept, needs an idea, like...
Why are you saying that? You just released a track this April, wasn't it?
Yeah, but it's... I don't know.
It's hardly retirement.
You ready? You're on it. You're back.
Like, I just need someone to ask, and the pen just moves on its own, man. Like, I don't know what it is. So as soon as you're ready, let me know.
Let's do a chat, three of us.
I'm serious. I'm not saying it for the podcast. You just say the word. I'm there.
Honestly, I would love that. Guys, thank you so much. Once again, that was an absolute privilege to talk to Chilani and Ben. To me, these guys typify this new breed of creatives. Creatives who are multi-talented, who defy labels or classification, whose careers encompass so many different art forms. In the case of Chilani and Ben, it's rap, comedy, poetry, saxophone playing, literature and visual media. I honestly don't know how they find time to fit it all in, but I always feel replenished speaking to artists like this, knowing that the future of culture is in safe hands. If you haven't listened already, check out 12 Questions by me, Fraser T. Smith, aka Future Utopia, available on all the major streaming services. And don't forget to subscribe and like this podcast. Also, ask yourself the 12 questions, ask other people the 12 questions. I put this record out to stir debate and hopefully create change. So why don't you send us your answers to the 12 questions on Instagram and Twitter at The Future Utopia. Last but not least, a massive shout out to Becky Voice at the Tape Agency, my management crew, Phil, Kate, Jasmine and Josh at 360 for helping make this podcast happen. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time. And until then, let's make the future a utopia.